Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In this program, we'll explore the big black hole where your dreams of prosperity used to be. Like rescue dogs, we'll sniff around the wreckage for the corpses and the survivors, the dead ends, and the new paths of living. In past shows, we presented top experts and authors. This time around, I just need to thrash this through with some intelligent people. What really is happening with the economy? Does this crash doom us to irreversible climate shift? We have alternative economic commentator Mike Whitney back on EcoShock for a go-round on the latest news. I'll tell you about the Global New Deal, or is it just the New World Order dressed up by the same old guys? Then we'll try something completely different. You and I will chat with a longtime Radio EcoShock listener about some better alternatives. We'll cover the triple threat from militarism, the collapsed economy, and the fragile climate. I'll ask her, does the upcoming Copenhagen Climate Conference really mean anything at all? Or should we go for relocalization and transition towns? All the issues swirling around in my mind and likely in yours too. We'll wrap up with another listener question. Is laughter really appropriate in these serious times? I'll let a Somalian musician tell us. Radio stew for an upset, bailed out world. This is EcoShock. The financial monster seems to eat famous companies and even whole countries overnight. It's hard to keep pace. To help us, our guest is financial analyst and prolific news hound Mike Whitney. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Alex. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you back again. And it's kind of a snake with a thousand heads when we want to talk about the financial situation. Where would you like to start? What's developing?
Oh, boy. As we speak, Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary, is on the Hill addressing Congress, and as can be expected, the congressional representatives don't seem to have any grasp of the financial situation. It's always amazing that of the 535 appointed representatives, there may be two or three that have any understanding of this unprecedented crisis and the crashing in the markets. They just, I guess, they spend most of their time, trying to connect campaign contributions. And they just don't have an understanding or a grip on what's going on, which is unfortunate because the Fed, according to Bloomberg News, has already underwritten the entire financial system with $11.4 trillion. And those are in loan guarantees and essentially a backstop for every area of the financial markets, including the money markets, commercial paper, and all the various other areas that that are under pressure currently. And at the same time, the Fed balance sheet has increased by $1.5 trillion. So there's a lot of money that is being issued without any sort of congressional oversight or approval.
Well, you know, people like Jim Rogers, the American who invests mainly in Asia, he says we should let big companies like AIG fail. He says governments, even the American government, simply don't have enough money to cover all these bad bets made by the crazy gamblers. Would you agree with that?
I would, but it is with the proviso that most people, that people try to understand how complicated this really is. When deregulation, and deregulation is basically a misnomer, what we had is people creating these illegal, underfunded, undercapitalized instruments, debt instruments, like credit default swaps, which allow someone to, like AIG, to issue insurance without sufficient capital in the event that the people has the bond defaults or that they have to make a payment on that insurance. So, in fact, all these credit default swaps that AIG had issued, they can't pay for because they don't have the resources. And people who would have had problems are apparently, according to the scuttlebutt on Wall Street, would have been Goldman Sachs, who would have been the next to fall beneath the axe if the government hadn't stopped in with a backstop. Now they have losses of another, what is it, $63 or $61 billion. So it's the government has to have deep pockets to even cover this. again, this is all money that's being provided without any kind of congressional supervision. The Fed is basically acting like an unelected oligarch that basically has just retaken control of the whole system without anyone's consent.
I always laugh when I hear people talking about the tax cuts for the rich. The rich, it turns out, don't really pay any taxes. They just get the money offshore like the drug dealers do. As you know, the new administration's launched this suit against the Swiss bank UBS to get a list of over 50,000 tax cheats. There's a major bank leading the charge to rob the American people of money that could have been used for Medicaid or whatever. What do you make of this sudden urge to expose tax havens like Switzerland, Antigua, and the Caymans?
You know, I'm not quite sure about that. It seems very politically motivated, but I think it really goes beyond that. I think it is similar to the surveillance programs that Bush illegally put into force. The people behind the curtain are, in fact, the giant financial institutions in the banking sector, which want to have a good idea of where every dime in the system goes, and thereby, with the power of the dollar being represented the international currency, they can basically control or have an understanding of where all the money is going. And I think it's just a matter of, knowledge is power. And so there's a certain amount of control. It's clear that they could use this for political purposes, but of all the people that they may be examining, it would only be the people who pose some sort of political threat or obstacle who would end up on the receiving end of that. I mean, the situation has to be so extreme, like the case of Bernie Madoff, to, garner the attention of the SEC or the other regulatory organizations. I mean, we have the biggest financial crisis in the history of this country that's accelerating at a pace that is faster than the Great Depression as far as the contraction. And how many indictments have we had so far? Not one. And yet we know that these people were benefiting from the proliferation of fraudulent securities in a scam that is larger than any in history. And yet still this passes without any kind of oversight and without any kind of penalties.
Yeah, we put 877,000 people in jail in 2007 for marijuana possession, but nobody in jail for $50 billion frauds. People who are out on the streets now, old people having to go back to work. They're 80 years old. They're looking for a job because they're wiped out by one of these scammers or even by just the main Wall Street companies. They had a Ponzi scheme going, as it turns out, now that all the values are dropping. And, one thing I've been wondering about, the people in other countries who trusted these American big names, Merrill Lynch and so on, they must be mad as hell that their sovereign funds and personal money is being wiped out. Have we seen any signs of this anger yet?
Well, yeah, we have. I'd like to backtrack for 1 minute, though, because when you talk about the amount of corruption in the system that is apparent to basically everyone with this huge scam and this money mortgage laundering system that went on for years, reaping trillions of dollars of rewards, and no one is being penalized. When we look at consumer confidence, that has a direct bearing on consumer spending, and see it as the lowest point in history. You can see that the fact that they have Obama propped up as a public relations gimmick. And he is supposed to, by his charismatic character and his great oratory, inspire confidence. That is not working. But the alternative is to straighten out the system so that certain people are held accountable, which they have no intention of doing. I mean, no one is accountable in the system anymore. So we should be looking for accountability and regulation. And on neither score are we hearing anything. I mean, all we hear is more obfuscation and more like Geithner today, asking essentially for more money for the speculators who put this thing together that blew up the whole system to begin with. So as far as the level of discontent, it's never been higher. Governments in Iceland and Latvia have already crumbled because of the insolvency of their banking system. There's been riots in Riga, in Lithuania, in Greece. There's been protests throughout the EU and in England. We haven't seen the only place where these forces seem to be inert right now is in the United States. But I think the level of anger has never been greater. And that's what makes it so confusing, because the support for Obama right now is unprecedentedly high. But at the same time, the amount of consumer confidence and the rage at the system itself has never been higher.
Well, Mike Whitney, in my opinion, the next wave of discontent may come from workers and seniors as they realize their pension funds have been gambled away or just aren't there. I've been looking at charts of how the big companies, even the major corporations, just don't have the money that they're supposed to have for their seniors. And the poor in most Western countries, and especially in the United States, have been amazingly quiet for decades. But this newly fallen middle class, I don't think they're going to go quietly into the trailer park and the homeless shelters. We may see some real social activism, but I haven't seen a movement as such come out of this. You know, I don't even know what you would call such a movement.
You know, there is no organized movement. You know, there's socialist groups and things of that sort, and anti-global, you know, the global justice movement. But as far as someone being able to, enlist the support of a great number of people across the country, that just hasn't happened yet. Although I think in this country we could still avoid, you know, street violence, protests, riots, etc., if there was some positive, proactive moves taken within the markets themselves, within government, to straighten things out. But that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing that Geithner and Summers and Bernanke, the people who are part of this banking cartel and the part of the system, which has essentially blown up the financial markets, are now working behind the smokescreen of Obama to enact things that only benefit or, you know, operate in the interests of the people who they serve, and those are their constituents. So I think we're getting closer and closer to violence because, you know, and I don't mean organized violence. I see it as evolving as far as sporadic violence in, you know, cities across the country where, you know, the unemployment rises to a level. You know, you can't take a middle-class, middle-aged man who has lived according to a certain lifestyle his entire life and shove him with a piece of cardboard under a freeway off-ramp and not expect there to be trouble eventually. I mean, the country is extremely well-armed, and we have a tradition of you know, reacting to things like this that I think is not, you know, doesn't inspire confidence. So, no, I think we're moving in that direction, and if corrective action isn't taken pretty soon, I think that could happen.
Well, maybe that's the pressure it'll take to break things open and be a little bit more real about what the country and its financial system are about. I'm wondering, what are some of the big stories you're following or things you think the mainstream media are soft-peddling?
Well, it might surprise you because it sounds rather boring, but we keep hearing the mantra, the banks aren't lending, and the banks are lending, and that is an intentional public relations campaign to divert attention from what's really happening. As a matter of fact, Mr. Geithner on CNBC just said what is really happening. It is the secondary market. It is the what they call the non-bank shadow banking system that has completely collapsed. That is the system of securitization that takes all, you know, your mortgage and your credit card debt and your student loans and packages them into securities and sells them to investors around the world. That doesn't sound very important, but that was creating over 40% of all the credit that is going into the system. Now think about that for a minute. If you look at you know, Ford's returns today, and there's a similarity between that and the exports of Japan and Korea and China, they're all dropping off at 35% to 40%. This is astronomical. This is larger than the drop-off in the Great Depression. And the reason is there's a symmetry between the amount of credit that has been extracted from the system or withdrawn from the system and the degree of the deceleration, the degree of the contraction. And that is essentially what's happening, is we have put the credit system in the hands of private speculators who have basically blown up the system and now there's not enough credit in the system to keep the financial system lubricated. And so the thing is crashing at a very alarming rate.
Yeah, I saw a BBC newsman just say sort of off the top of his head, well, the Japanese economy fell off a cliff today, and then he went on to cover other stories. And I thought, oh boy, this is the world's second biggest economy going down the tubes. Well, if people want to read more of your work and find out what you've got to say, where should they be looking?
Well, I'm usually posted on counterpunch.org and Information Clearinghouse and Global Research. And I'm sure you'll find something to read there that's out of the mainstream that'll spark your curiosity. And I thank you very much for giving me this time.
Oh, it's always a treat to have you here on Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Mike Whitney from Washington State. And you know, people, Mike donates his time. There's no money involved in any of this, so we doubly appreciate that, too.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Radio EcoShock.
Watch out. The same old crowd is already rearranging their deck chairs on the economic Titanic. You may not see it, but I'm going to tell you about it. And probably there won't be enough lifeboats for most of us.
I think we are fashioning for the future a global deal, a grand bargain.
When UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown whisked into Washington to meet President Obama, he carried a bomb under his arm. At least he thought his global grand bargain would rearrange the world, but it may be a dud. Make no mistake, Brown's plan, renamed a Global New Deal for American audiences, is the New World Order by another name. It is the oligarchy responding to its sudden weakness in power. The billion-dollar men meet, swap and discount debts, remake the currency, rename everything, and pray they can remain in control. There is not a whiff of democracy to it. A bargain for who? The deal is twisted with self-contradictions. While the plan funds green energy, it demands more dependable delivery of fossil fuels from Russia. The bargain ridiculously emphasizes trade deals like the Doha Round, which are pointless now that the freighters are tied up at the docks. Trade is collapsing. The old cycle of debt, consumption, and piracy is over. Last year, Gordon Brown basked in his 15 minutes of love, the only popularity he's had so far, after he tossed billions of taxpayers' money into the dying British banks. That turned out to be a total loss, leading to hundreds of billions more total losses. But this global grand bargain isn't his idea anyway. It was made in America and launched by two voices of power in the journal Foreign Policy in November 2008. One of the authors of the foreign policy article is Frederick Kemp. At one time, Kemp was editor and associate publisher of the Wall Street Journal. Now he is president of the Atlantic Council of the United States. Haven't heard of it? Well, guess what? That's because you're not a member. A quick look through their directors and honorary directors shows the usual names of American white power and their reps like Brent Scowcroft and Henry Kissinger. The Atlantic Council wants to build Atlantic power from America to the northern European states, the old alliance of the mainly English-speaking world. Gordon Brown says, I have always been an Atlanticist. The other author of the foreign policy bargain is Robert Hutchings, chairman of the U.S. National Intelligence Council, the NIC, from 2003 to 2005, a top prince of spooks. Now Hutchings is listed as diplomat in residence at Princeton University. Who does Robert Hutchings represent? This plan to redistribute world power, or at least acknowledge new realities, really comes from the 2008 report of the National Intelligence Council, formerly headed by Robert Hutchings, with credits this time to the Atlantic Council. The report titled Global Trends 2025, A Transformed World, was handed to Barack Obama on his inauguration. According to this intelligence community summary, the global trends seem realistically bleak. Unlike Dick Cheney's militaristic New American Century, the NIC analysts predict American power will decline as the axis of wealth passes from West to Asia, exactly the same warning repeatedly made by the American investor Jim Rogers.
By the way, the money is in Asia now. The money is certainly not in the West anymore. Maybe the Asians will ride to the rescue of the West, but I cannot conceive that they would.
The Intelligence Council also recognized that global warming will reduce water availability, harm food production, raise tensions, and will push hundreds of millions of people towards cooler and wetter climate zones. Good for them, they got that right. These American analysts also worry that nuclear fear and possible nuclear explosions will continue to threaten us in the next decades. The report replaces the former policy based on the triumph of the will in the Cheney days with a reality check.
Who are they? They are the dark armies.
These intelligence people want to reshape the current world to fit new realities while minimizing the damage to the current power structures. For example, the so-called World Bank has always been controlled by the North Atlantic countries and always has an American as its head. America is the major provider of funds for it and often calls the tune to suit capitalist ideology and pocketbooks and big American corporations. Now the NIC suggests perhaps some other world economies might be represented in the World Bank. Maybe even China could be part of it. Ditto with the International Monetary Fund. They want to keep it going, and that's too bad because most environmentalists, social activists, and poor nations would dance happily into the night if both institutions died a quiet death as they should instead of being propped up since World War II. The World Bank financed the most damaging dams, the deforestation, the climate-popping coal plants. The IMF always demanded draconian punishments of the poor, including taking away subsidies on bread. Let them eat bonds, not to mention the privatization of their water and all their goods. There is a declassified version of the Global Trends 2025 report now on the net at www.dni.gov/NIC. dni.gov/NIC. There are some good ideas there, but most of it looks like damage control to me, and I'm sure emerging superpowers like China and India see it the same way. It's a bird with no wings, even though some of the recommendations will be implemented just because there's no other way out for a declining American elite. Next time you hear about a global new deal, you'll know who is dealing the cards and what they hope to win. Some shadowy group proposes this global grand redesign at our time of panic, exactly as predicted by Naomi Klein in her book Disaster Capitalism. We have to watch very closely now as the power dealers try to stack the deck, calling it a global new deal. As billionaires and their political leaders panic, they will try anything. They won't consult you and I. Some rowdy columnists like Ambrose Evans-Pritchard of the UK Telegraph even call for shock and awe policies to stop the depression. Expect more financial bombs to fall and institutions to crumble, but keep your eyes out for those people running around in the ruins with briefcases full of grand global bargains. It's the same old, and it won't work anymore. That's my opinion. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I confess to spreading the rumor on orders from Goldstein that the war is not really with Eurasia, but with East Asia. And that for years, in fact, since the days of our glorious revolution, I had no faith in our future. I forged government announcements and falsified figures quoted for agricultural and industrial as a result of mental disturbance dating from my experiences during the atomic wars.
Here on Radio EcoShock, we talk a lot about the triple threat. Three main elements that have converged into a joint crisis. You know what I'm talking about. I would say these are the economy, climate, and peak oil. But a listener, an email correspondent from California, prefers these ones. War/empire, the economic crash, and climate along with the environment in general. Those are her big three, and I appreciate being reminded about the role of militarism and world domination in our current crisis. I remember, too, when peak oil sites didn't mention climate change. Now they do, and everyone knows the economy is a possible knockout blow. Just consider the hardship to the American image, well, most Westerners, who might not only be losing their own job or home with all the self-image that that represents and the friends that went along with it, and then they learn that their country may no longer be the greatest power of the world. A double hit on identity that has been deeply programmed into each of us. We'll talk about that. We also discussed the personal and psychological cost of hard times, and let's pick up our conversation there. We built ourselves, our guest says, constructed on an identity.
Constructed on an identity and a sense of security that they essentially have never gone through hard times before, whereas other people who've spent their whole lives dealing with hard times may psychologically find it easier to contend with, even though they're actually faced with much more difficult circumstances. So, you know, and I think classically, if you look at, there's a gender aspect to it too, that historically, you know, men were the ones who suffered more on retirement because so much of their social life was organized around work. Of course, since more women have gone into the workforce, we have that as well. But it's interesting to see how, you know, some of the structures of resilience that poor communities have, communities of color, and other people who've been disadvantaged by the economy that was, those structures of resilience may serve us well going forward. And then to continue on to the sort of the empire question or the world power question, it was interesting this fall to watch officialdom, even still under Bush, acknowledge this. I mean, there were some reports saying we're sort of seeing that we're no longer going to be the world dominant power. I don't think the empire is going to give up that easily, but I think there is some recognition that we're undergoing a massive, potentially massive, reorganization of global power, and the whole sense that we've gone from the Cold War world of the U.S. versus the Soviet Union to this moment of triumphalism where it was a unipolar world, supposedly, and now really it's not. It's a multipolar world, and the question is, can we live inside that sustainably? Can we find peace? How do we do that? I mean, we have at least three major powers with ambitions for global political and economic hegemony. So I think it's a very open and fluid time.
Well, it seems to me, as a Canadian watching a lot of American media, that the American media has really pumped up this idea, especially during the War of Terror years in the Bush administration, that the U.S. is number one, will always be number one. We had the Project for a New American Century, which seemed to me to say that American military power would establish itself by force, would establish a new empire by force. Well, that's gone by the way, and now we have a new national intelligence estimate that comes out and says, well, in fact, a lot of the wealth has transferred over to Asia, and we expect a multipolar world in which America will play a part. So we are seeing some adjustments being made, but I wonder how difficult that's going to be for the average American who's been fed patriotism in the extreme for so long.
Yeah, I think that is difficult because feeds into this sort of psychological process we were talking about before with people contending with the economy, that when so many parts of our identities and our sense of security and our sense of who we are and our power in the world, even if we're just identifying in our minds with our national power, for people who are being threatened, you know, economically, if they feel like they're also being threatened in their national identity, I do think that's a lot to bring at someone, and I think that's where we get the danger of right-wing, you know, populism. And because people are so afraid and they feel so assaulted in the way that their identity has been constructed, that it's a danger we have to deal with. But I also think that the acceptance or non-acceptance of the multipolar world is very much still in play among elites. I think some elites have reconciled themselves to the fact that the United States is one among at least several in the world. But I suspect that there is a significant class of people with global economic power and influence who have not accepted that and are looking to continue the storyline and their sense of the trajectory of history. So I think we have probably a period where we will continue to have a struggle among elites for those who want to sort of accommodate, and, you know, the way Microsoft and Apple had to learn to accommodate to each other because nobody was going to win. And then I think there will be some other elites who will not and will continue to try to dominate the world. And then another question comes for progressives. Is there some way we can exploit those divisions?
Ah, now you're getting into some interesting territory. Now, what would we be aiming at as progressives then?
Well, You know, that's a big question, obviously. I'm not going to answer in terms of a platform of issues. I mean, I think there are lots of good big platforms out there about basic social safety net, basic social justice, and that means both within countries and between countries and between the global north and the global south. But I think strategically and in terms of vision, we need to ask ourselves this question: do we want a solution, for example, to the financial crisis, meaning do we want to try to fix the system, or do we want an alternative to the financial system that we have, meaning do we want to replace the system? And I think most progressives around the world are very much ready to replace the system, but I think our elites are still talking about fixing the system. So I do think it's a sort of, in the United States, it's a little bit delicate right now because, you know, you might want to give Obama the benefit of the doubt. A lot of progressives have done that. You might want to give him as much support as you can and build political space for him to, say, fix our healthcare system or provide a green jobs economy. But at the same time, you know, many of us see that the banks are still being bailed out and there's still good reasons to oppose the way it's being done. So I think the political calculus about what sort of reforms to support versus what sort of major radical alternatives to start working toward is not easy. And maybe the answer is we just have to pick some from each side and figure out, you know, what are the holding actions that we absolutely have to maintain people in their homes and to prevent people from dying from medical neglect and, you know, really to prevent hunger in this country. And then what can we start building at the same time as alternatives? Because I think we have to seize this moment as a serious, fundamental crisis of legitimacy of everything we've been told was how it had to be, how it was naturally, there is no alternative, you know, and start to articulate our alternatives. It's not so much for me to answer, but I would say there is a global community that has spoken in a diverse way about what that new plan should be. I'm just reading a new report from Global Labor Strategies called Globalization from Below Tackles the Great Recession. And I think that's a great example of a group that's been working with labor and climate together to try to look at what are some alternatives we can work for.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I've just read about Gordon Brown meeting with Obama. He's got a new global grand deal or global grand bargain, they're calling it. And it sounds like the same old people who have been in power for quite a long time wanting to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak, and to hold on to those same avenues of power, some of which really haven't worked out, and especially when it comes to the injustice and imbalance, as you talk about, between humans, but also with our climate and environment. And I wanted to just bridge over a little bit. I don't know a lot about this upcoming Copenhagen meeting of climate. I don't really understand what's at stake there, and I'm not sure my listeners have really been that interested, honestly. So can you tell us a little bit about it and what possible hope we could get out of it?
Sure. Well, you know, Copenhagen in December of this year is where the process that brought us the Kyoto Treaty, Kyoto Protocol, is going to negotiate a successor treaty to Kyoto, which officially runs out in 2012. So this process is happening under the UN, under what's called the UN Framework on Climate Change, and UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, rather. And the concept is basically that the nations of the world come together and agree on a treaty which will commit us to certain amounts of greenhouse gas reduction and other actions, supposedly to address the climate crisis. Now, it's not just an agreement about who's going to reduce how much by when, but that, of course, is the core of it. And the convention is divided into two groups of countries, what are called the Annex I countries, which by and large are the rich countries, and then the Annex II countries, which are by and large the developing countries or the poor countries. So there's an expectation that the Annex I countries will reduce more because we are more responsible for the greenhouse gases that are already there, and that we will reduce earlier because we can. And we have, you know, further to go, so we need to get started sooner. Because it costs money to transform your infrastructure to become a low-carbon economy, there is also a broad expectation that the richer countries will assist the poorer countries in actually making that transition. So this is part of the convention as well, funding and possibly technology transfer to enable the developing countries to do their part in reducing their emissions. And there are a few other aspects, but those are the main aspects of the treaty. In terms of giving us hope, well, I think that a treaty, ultimately what it becomes is a tool that you use to hold your own government accountable. And so I think most people who are working on this politically want to make sure that the treaty that's negotiated is as tough and as ambitious as possible, and also critically that it's as fair as possible, meaning that we give, you know, really sufficient commitments of funds to the developing countries, that they can make the transition, that they can afford to do that while still developing and feeding their people. It's pretty much understood that the Global South will not sign a deal that doesn't contain sufficient equity and funding for them to play their part in that way. So many of us see this equity component, this fairness component between the Global North and the Global South as pretty much the linchpin of negotiations, aside from some of the big emitters like the United States and China sort of making backroom deals before the meeting, which is already, those discussions are well underway.
I wonder, is there any role here for activists, and I've heard some activist scientists are planning on attending and doing something, but is this something that we as the interested public sit back and watch, or is there a way that we can participate or put some pressure to get good results?
Well, first I want to say something about the activist scientists, and then I'll talk about ways for people to participate. The activist scientists are actually getting together well before Copenhagen. They're getting together this month, next week. In Copenhagen, March 10th through 12th, there's going to be an international sort of scientific congress on climate change sponsored by and held at the University of Copenhagen. And it's hoped at this conference that the scientists who attend will sort of give us the official update, which is basically to say the IPCC report was an enormous service to humanity. In many ways, it's an authoritative document. And in many ways, it was very much an understatement, as we've seen with the actual outcomes of both climate science research and the, you know, both the emissions of carbon into the atmosphere, as well as the outcomes in the climate system that have been coming much harder and much faster than was predicted in the IPCC report, as you've covered in your show. So the first thing is to say that, you know, the scientific community is really stepping up in this way, and I hope they have a good media strategy, and I hope they get a lot of coverage. In terms of participating and having an influence on the climate negotiations, you know, there are a couple of ways to do that. Some people are focused on, you know, there's a vast, almost an industry of papers, studies, and proposals that are being created. So the academic community and the NGO community are putting materials on the table to suggest language and suggest programs for how to implement various pieces of the treaty. So for people who are in those communities, there's already sort of a channel for doing that. At the meetings itself, there is a whole role and official place for non-governmental organizations to participate. So that happens already, and that will happen. In terms of people who are not already plugged into those, there's a citizens group on the web for sort of public input about the issue, and it's being sponsored, I think, by the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention folks.
If you have just tuned in, this is Alex Smith, mulling over our current crisis with a Radio EcoShock listener from California as my guest. Our California caller suggests Worldwide Views as a website for citizen input into the Copenhagen Climate Conference coming up this December. That's at www.views.org. Back to our chat on the triple crisis. for those of us who aren't willing to wait, you know, 10 years for some new plan to come along, you've also mentioned the idea, and others have been working on this, of course, of transition towns and what we can do in our local communities. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. The transition towns movement, I'm not sure if they were the originators, but I'll tell you who I heard about it from, and that was Rob Hopkins, and he's in the UK, and he lives in a small town called Totnes, T-O-T-N-E-S. And he started, a couple years ago, he started a group called Transition Town Totnes, and they sort of decided, we see this crisis coming, meaning the climate crisis and the peak oil crisis, and we're going to start organizing our town in preparation for this. We're going to figure out how to relocalize our economy. And so, for example, he says in England, where he's working, if you go down the high street, which is the equivalent of our main street, he said if you look at the records from 100 years ago, you can say, here was where the flour was milled. Here was where the shoes were made. Here was where the local bank was. And a lot of that has gone away, but some of it remains, and the rest potentially could be brought back, especially in smaller towns. There's agricultural land not too far away, and so there's a possibility for a more local food economy. For example, one very practical thing that Rob Hopkins talks about is they're trying to get the city, whenever they plant trees or, you know, other foliage in public places and parks, not to plant ornamental trees, which, as he points out, we've spent a lot of time developing, but rather, why not plant a fruit tree or a nut tree or something that will actually provide food for people as well as all the other features of shade and pleasant appearance. So it's a very pragmatic community-building type of response, which is both economic and social in its nature.
Well, I guess any of us could look that up and try and see if we can get our own town to be a transition town. I've got some websites I'm going to be giving our listeners, including relocalize.net and places like Peak Moment TV and postcarbon.org. All of those places have more on relocalizing. I kind of wanted to get to another point that you raised in an email. You said it may not be enough to organize locally like that, though, if the powers of militarism and manipulation somehow remain in power. Is there something that we have to act to remove? I mean, you said, well, they have a plan and we don't. What are we going to do about that?
Well, I think the simplest and most obvious answer, at least within the United States, is that we have to start talking about the military budget. For some reason, it sort of became undiscussable in the last 10 years or so. I mean, I remember in the 80s and early 90s when we had budget crises and the bases were being closed, and because the Cold War was ending, there was the term peace dividend. And that was, hey, you know, supposedly we've had to spend all this money on nuclear weapons and all these conventional weapons and bases and armies because we've had a, you know, imminent threat from the Soviet Union for however many decades, and that's gone, so let's take that money and spend it on jobs, health, housing, education, you know, whatever. Somehow, even though we don't have an imminent military threat aside from the supposed the war on terrorism, which thankfully Obama has abandoned at least rhetorically, we don't have anywhere near the same kind of military threat, and yet we still have the huge military budget and, you know, we've had in the United States appropriations on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars on top of the standard Pentagon budget several times a year throughout the entire Iraq war. And, you know, now we have another emergency appropriation for the Afghanistan war. So I think this is where bringing in not only labor and the people responding to the financial crisis, not only peak oil, not only climate change, but really the anti-war movement obviously is centrally related, because we have to go after the Pentagon budget, and that's by far the simplest thing we can do practically. I think we also need to keep our eyes open strategically for the use of climate change as a pretext for intervention. You know, in the last several decades, there have been a number of quote-unquote humanitarian interventions by the United States. And usually, I would say, these quote-unquote interventions have been promoting U.S. geostrategic objectives. There may be a humanitarian side benefit, but it, in many ways it could be seen as window dressing towards a geopolitical agenda. There is evidence that some are thinking about climate change in the same way, because it will actually cause substantial dislocation, environmental refugees, drought, you know, hunger. People are going to be on the move. It may cause conflicts. There is already in the 2008 National Intelligence Assessment, which was done on climate, there's some indication that it may be used as a reason for intervening in other countries and continents, and particularly in the African continent. So I think we need to keep our eyes open, and we need to say that even if there's a humanitarian crisis because of climate change, which undoubtedly there will be, it doesn't mean that we have to send in the Marines. We can give money to UN adaptation funds instead. We need to proactively be on this. And it's another reason to support the global equity aspects of the Copenhagen Agreement and support a global fund to transfer money to the developing countries, because we want to solve the problem on the ground before it arrives, to the extent that we can, rather than waiting till a crisis occurs and then saying we have to send in the army.
You know, I've seen some. I love to read the comments on a lot of blogs, and some of them are really wild, of course, especially the anonymous ones. But, you know, I saw one where it said, well, you know, if climate really gets out of hand, we may have to bomb the coal-producing, the electricity plants in China. And I thought to myself, do you realize as you type this that 50% of electricity in America is generated by coal? I mean, if we're going to bomb any plants, let's start at home. And, and we don't want to bomb anything. And that's the last thing that I'd like to get to. And I've seen implications that war is coming. It's just around the bend. In fact, I'll probably have a guest on next week who feels that way. But I just have to feel that there is another whole alternative scenario, which is just as plausible, which is that if things get really bad, the center may fall apart. Mm-hmm. The big militarism may fall apart. We may not be able to pay for all those bases all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so people may be just plain tired of all of that and want to organize in peaceful ways. We may surprise ourselves on, I know it sounds airy-fairy, but some of the goodness that comes out of people in these hard times.
Yes, I think there's, just as there is in human nature, great potential for us to be sublime toward each other, there's also great potential for us to be violent and evil towards each other. I think that's true in this historical moment, and it's true with the climate challenge. And because the forces I talked about earlier, you know, people whose national identity and their personal identity is tied up with a sense of national supremacy or with racial identity, because those psychologies have been constructed, and because we have things like right-wing talk radio, I think there's a potential for mobilizing people in a very negative way. And I think it's up to us to be out there, and, you know, if not on AM radio, then maybe it's on YouTube. I don't know where we go, but to really offer a different vision of the future of cohabitation, cooperation. I agree with you. A lot of people are tired, and the American public, by and large, has been against our various wars for a long time. It's just that our views are not reflected by elites. They're not reflected by the people that we get to choose between for our congressional representatives, by and large. So I do think it's a time when someone who can articulate a different vision, and I don't mean an individual, although charismatic individuals help, I think there's a hunger for another vision, and I think we need to put it out there, because the dystopian visions are so available, you know, that war is coming, war is inevitable, collapse is coming. You know, there's going to be strife, there's going to be civil war, and if you listen to the right-wing, or I'm not sure if they're even right-wing sites, but, you know, there's a lot of fear of martial law, there's a lot of fear that they are going to, you know, impose a new currency on us, the Amero. Well, what if we think about it a different way? What if we say that, yes, the center is collapsing, and at some point, maybe we want to develop a different currency, you know? Maybe we want to do it on our terms. Currency is just an example. But I think there may be positive ways to undermine a very sick and dysfunctional system. And there may be ways to do that with popular control. So I think we need to start thinking big and offering visions of alternative futures and also asking people for their ideas, because I think there are a lot of great ideas out there that probably haven't gotten a good airing.
Boy, that's a really good place to kind of draw this to a close, I think. Is there something else that you'd like to add or other websites or ideas you want to toss in as we wrap this up?
The only other thing I was going to say was that I like the metaphor of the extractive world system, whether you call it capitalism or imperialism. I like the metaphor of that as an octopus that's sort of got its tentacles and its suckers all over the globe. And if you're trying, not that I would want to kill an octopus, but if you're trying to attack something that has both a global center or centers and it has tentacles, then you can hurt the beast at both ends. And I think what we've seen with Kyrgyzstan standing up to the United States and saying, we don't want to host your military base, just like Ecuador stood up to the United States and said, we don't want to host your military base. And of course, unless you want to let us have an Ecuadorian military base in Florida, and then we can make a deal. But I think people in the third world are showing us a model of resistance, and they're doing it at the tentacles. And we need to figure out coordinated strategies of resistance more at the heart of the beast that can bring down those pillars of power that are causing the problem. Not necessarily everything, but we need to do what the movement that brought down Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia did, which was, their analysis was, we're going to identify the three key pillars of state power, and we're going to systematically undermine them. I think here we, again, may not want to take our entire government down, but we might want to disassemble pieces of it. We certainly, I think, want to disassemble the empire and the wars that go with it. And ultimately, we would like to disassemble the structure of monopoly global finance capital, which is hurting everyone except the very, very few at the top. So, again, I think working with our allies in the third world who've shown forms of resistance, we need to figure out the complementary forms of resistance that will attack the proper pillars in our own country, in the heart of the beast, as we call it.
And when it comes to surviving tough times, we've got everything to learn from people in South America, for example, or Africa or in the Middle East, because they've been under pressure and they know how to do it. So we do have a lot to learn from each other, more than we know, I think.
Yeah, and now we have the opportunity to do that in a way that more, you know, in the past it was more specialists in anthropology who might know about those strategies, but now we have the internet. So we know, for example, that Wangari Maathai's Green Belt movement in Kenya not only got women to plant trees to help, you know, have a place for shade and developing a better hydrological cycle in the region, but also they planted fruit trees because why, again, would you plant a non-fruit-bearing tree when you have the opportunity to produce food? So I think that's an example where the first world, the transition town folks, have really taken a lesson from the third world, and there are many, many more out there like that.
Well, let's use that as an image for what we have to do in general. We have to plant fruit-bearing trees, things that bear fruit that not only humanity needs, but that nature herself can thrive with. Thank you so much for this talk today.
My pleasure.
Our Radio EcoShock listener has pinpointed the need for a convergence of movements for social change. We don't yet have a name for it. This coming wave of popular agreement on a new way forward, peacefully, sustainably, in a livable climate. It's a movement without a name. Yet. Here are some helpful websites for you to get more information, so grab a pen or keyboard to capture the info. You can also find this list of links in my blog entry for March 5th. Hit the blog button at our website, ecoshock.org. One of the key focal points that I use, relocalize.net, has announced it will no longer be active after March 1st. When I last checked, they were still there online, with a long list of relocalization groups in the United States and around the world. Find the one nearest you or start your own. I like peakmoment.tv. That's peakmoment.tv. Many of their programs are on YouTube or linked through the net. You hear the experts from outside Wall Street, plus reports from real alternative makers in the field. Watch a bunch of their back shows for good ideas. Author Richard Heinberg and friends like author and speaker Julian Darley can be found at postcarbon.org. They've been looking at life after fossil fuels for some time now, and they have a lot of suggestions about where we're headed. They have a related multimedia posting site, globalpublicmedia.com. That one used to be only peak oil, but has since added some climate change radio, video, and text, as well as community rebuilding info, globalpublicmedia.com. I've also joined the Global Warming Crisis Council, a group started in California to exchange information via a listserv, which sends out key emails. It's mainly inhabited by activists and potential activists. Search for Global Warming Crisis Council. It's hosted out of the culturechange.org website.
Are you pondering what I'm pondering?
Yes, Brain, I think we are all pondering the same basic questions. What the hell is going on, and what can we do about it? Join me in the search for answers on Radio EcoShock on your local college or community radio station, by satellite and podcast, or download it free from our website, ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. The opening horns for this show were a little bit from Joel Plaskett, who will feature next week as our artist. You also heard a little bit from the Oracle, Max Kaiser Show. Don't forget, maxkaiser.com. You've got to check that out for the latest in the financial news. And we also had a little bit from the film 1984. What could be more appropriate when we're talking about the Grand Global Bargain? Finally, I want to thank all of you who wrote in. I love your email. Write me anytime, radio@ecoshock.org. Ian asks if laughter is a normal response to the terrible news these days. It's a serious question. I do fool around with comedy clips and laugh at some of the worst headlines, but I do think that's natural and necessary. Otherwise, Jon Stewart wouldn't make a living, and we couldn't face this crack up at all. Love and good times are just what we need, no matter what comes, I say. We'll hear that from this clip from Kanan, the Canadian artist who grew up in Somalia, where 10-year-old kids learn how to fire Kalashnikov machine guns. It's spelled K upon N-A-A-N. This rap sensation spreading out worldwide now. From his album Troubadour, this is Dreamer.
Hey, yo, check it out. What would it take for a boy about my age to hear cheers in his head upon that stage? And the cheers, they would drown out the tears from my brown eyes. Come on backstage, you see the screams ain't the screams from gunshot screams. In my dreams, these screams are from hot teens. And I'm barely 13, a pack of dirty old Russian firearm that shoots 30. Just then I hit a bus engine, I'm transcending, I'm crowd surfing. I can't see the town burning, I'm not hurting with my mahogany pen. I'm on a world tour with Muhammad and them. And we'd be overseas and not in these streets. When my peeps stay alive like the Bee Gees. And the likes of Jay-Z would say my steez. Singing handily brought hip-hop peace. I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one. Got problems, but we love to have fun. This is our world, from here to your hood. We alive, man, it's okay to feel good. I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one. Got problems, but we love to have fun. This is our world, from here to your hood. Light me up now, it's okay to feel good. I'm a dreamer. Sometimes we just like to have fun, man. We like to forget all the fighting, all the guns and the tires burning. Back on the verse, imagine crack wasn't birth. Imagine the earth wasn't hurt. Imagine no homeland alerts. Imagine no record locator, so I wouldn't have to get a criminal waiver. Imagine the peace wasn't in my briefs. Instead peace could stretch across the seas. So finally we could just rest in the ease. No refugees. And you, well you could dress in a book, and I could read your body with less than a look. I got a dream girl in my mind, that's the hook. An intellectual, sexual, and still can cook. Yeah, yeah. And I feel good right now. I feel good right here. You feel good right now? You feel good? I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one. Got problems, but we love to have fun. This is our world. From here to your hood, we alive, man. It's okay to feel good. I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one. Got problems, but we love to have fun. This is our world. From here to your hood, light me up now. It's okay to feel good. I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one. Got problems, but we love to have fun. This is our world. From here to your hood, we alive, man. It's okay to feel good. I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one. Got problems, but we love to have fun.
just because the times are